I'm Christopher Lydon from Koshi's Cafe in Bangalore, the IT capital of India. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Koshi's Cafe is a lot like Rick's Cafe in Casablanca of old in the movies. It was started about the same time, 1940. The Humphrey Bogart, the Rick of Koshi's, is Prem Koshi at my right. He's the grandson of the founder. We're sitting at the square table. His knights of the square table gather whenever they like and talk about everything. These are oil men, bankers, high-tech entrepreneurs, students, photographers, artists, men, women of considerable spread of ages, and we're privileged just to sit in and talk from here. May I just say, by way of introduction, I came to India in 1963. I was just out of college. I'll never forget watching Prime Minister Nehru with Krishna Menon walk through the Ashoka Hotel with the United States Ambassador John Kenneth Galbraith. I was very touched by Nehru. He died the next year. Krishna Menon was fired over the war in China, so it was, in a certain sense, the end of an era. It was a funny time. Amartya Sen complained that at that period, India had no power, but it talked like a house of fire, with Krishna Menon especially. Nowadays, India has huge power, and it doesn't talk enough. That's why we're here. It's so wonderful to be in a 5,000-year-old civilization. It's a great lesson in humility for our country. The unipolar power, which is barely 250 years old. It's also wonderful to see India so full of itself. It's also wonderful to be in a place where everybody talks fast all the time. Prem Koshi, would you just introduce some of your friends and tell us, what are we thinking about today? What are we talking about? What are we fighting about?
Well, I don't know if we're fighting about anything, but we're discussing all kinds of things on the table. From the Israelis to Palestine to India and I think to the United States, of course, ultimately ends up there. So,
you learned to bake in Kansas.
Yes, I learned to bake in Kansas. I ran a couple of nightclubs in Louisiana, bartendered, and bring back some of that good old cuisine. Yeah. All right. So generally a really good time. And now I'm back home, ready to see India move out from a diaper stage and into our adulthood, yeah. And I'm happy to be here. And all my friends here, Hamid, Anu, Satish, Ashok, Vivek, Shovan Sab, and of course, Madam Roshan, yeah, who's with us. We join, come together every morning, sit around, discuss everything under the sun. We try to also help people on any level. Our motto is, how can we help? So if on any level we can help, we all get together, pull in our resources, and as you know, each one brings a couple of thousand years of good, solid knowledge with us. So
the table by the window is the place to be.
Ladies and knights of the square table, we call us, because we hopefully are gallant and, you know, ride in to rescue whoever needs rescuing or a little help. So
Ashok, you've been in information technology 20 years probably, through the boom. What's next? What's the next wave?
Well, I think in a way it's going to build on what came before it. And what you actually had was you had a whole bunch of young people who created an industry from the ground up. And they were not following in anybody's footsteps. There was no rule book written for this industry. And that's given them the ability to pick up something new and run with it. I think that's the most important lesson from the IT industry. So whether they're in software or not, they've got the ability, they've got the tools, they've got the methods and the confidence to go after any opportunity that they see. And I think that's coming next. And in which area? Well, like I said, you can get lists of areas, you know, listing everything from renewable energy to pharmaceuticals to whatever. But the important thing is that you've got hundreds of thousands of people who are willing, have the ability and the confidence to run with any idea that sort of seizes them.
How does it work? Is it ones and twos? Are the financiers critical? Do you have venture capital that decides among the winners? Or are all these kids in coffee shops doing it pretty much by the seat of their pants?
Well, I think, for sort of our generation, which has been through this and sort of stepped out for a while, we enjoy the seat of the pants. Because once it formalizes and the suits come in, some of us like to drop out and start all over again. And what's happening is, I think you have a point there, that the ecosystem has formed. So you have all these various creatures, like the venture capitalists and all the others, and the marketing people and the contacts in different parts of the world, all lying around. And so anyone can sort of put this together. And it's not as daunting as it would have been in the 1960s or 70s, when there was no capital available, no expertise, no exposure to the world.
Satish, can I ask you the nasty question? We went to the slum the day before yesterday. It's a big, stinking, poor, polluted, miserable feeling place. A lot of vitality there, to be sure. But people say it grew up right with the success stories. And it's not only never been eradicated, nobody planned for any other place for the service workers of Bangalore to live. How can that be?
See, you must understand that we are actually a nation with too much of population and too little resources. So the urbanization of a particular city causes people to move away from land which is valuable, and people move out and form a slum because that's all they can afford.
What a visitor like me remembers is that the new wealth of India is not eliminating the old poverty.
So this is happening at a slow pace, very, very slow. But I think as the pace picks up, the slums will slowly disappear. People will demand good housing, good luxury, and there's a pressure on the people manufacturing because there's a huge base. I will tell you a very simple example. Many of us, if you go into the rural area, we don't use a toothpaste or a toothbrush. We use a stick. Now, marketing people have said that if they introduce people to come to see somebody brushing the teeth with the toothpaste, no company in the country can meet the demand. It's a huge market which is opening.
Are you going to buy one?
No, I'm definitely using a toothbrush and a toothpaste.
Who uses a toothbrush?
Yeah, all of us. All of us, I guess. But for many years, and when we were kids, we used charcoal and salt. Yeah? And my uncles and my great-granduncles still use the mango leaf. They've never been to a dentist. With all our toothpastes and all that, we're in and out of the dentist every other day. And my granduncles still laugh at us in Kerala, for instance. If you go into the villages, you see all of these kids having a piece of, they have it, what do they call it?
There's
a neem stick or different. Yeah, they can use it. Yeah, so.
Do I dare ask about paper to wipe your bottom with?
Well, whoa, can you imagine the number of trees you guys have been cut in to wipe your bums with? No, excuse me. But, we use water, and that's, we've been doing that for so long. I mean, it gets recycled, moves along the way, but, natural is the best. Now, about this trickling down effect, it's the 80-20 law that's at work. Now what India needs to do is bring the 80% of those people up. Nature's law of 80-20, you know that, right? That says that if you take all the wealth, equally distributed, in a little while, 20% of the people will control, again, all the wealth, and 80% will sort of support them. And in nature, it works too. 20% usually is the strongest part of nature's crop, and 80% usually are the fringe that actually die, and then the trickle-down effects that work with it. So we need to move this 80% of people that we have, 20% has all the wealth and education and all that going good. We need to move them from the 80% into the 20%, So that's the balance we need to strike, I think. And we have that population, vibrant population of youngsters coming up. Most of the rest of the world has gone old. I don't know whether to blame education, but in Kerala, we have now zero population growth. But the rest of the country hopefully is producing our new crop of youngsters that are coming up and going to keep us going. So
let me ask, though, Kerala is an exception. It's been a communist state for most of the last 50 years. What would it take in the slum in Bangalore? And it's a very big place. What would it take to put transit in there, sewage in there, and really good education starting from day one?
Well, yes, education is extremely important. And we are talking of starting with basic literacy and number skills, which I think the large majority of Indians currently don't have access to. I think there's no question, and that's India's shame. I too would like to mention that this spirit of being gung-ho actually clouds over some of the real things. India, I think, needs people who can see things and, you know, say that the emperor has no clothes. For example, urbanization and this current model of development, which I think is the most horrible thing. We've seen the developed economies having gone through with it, and yet we seem to be helpless. No one is helpless. We wish to be helpless, and we follow the same models with the same consequences. We are rending our social fabric. We are destroying our environment, and yet we maintain that this is the only way. I doubt whether that's the only way. Of course it's not. But there you are. Either you are for this kind of thing, or you are a Cassandra, you're a leftist, you're some environmentalist, and all kinds of names, unfortunately. I think that
I'm so glad to hear you say that. We went to Tamil Nadu, into rice farming and sugarcane farming villages yesterday. They're so beautiful.
Yes.
They're so green.
Yes.
It feels so healthy.
Yes.
People will say that's caveman, old-time stuff. On the other hand, it's a beautiful way to live.
Yes.
And people are more than content. They're happy. They're connected. Who's pushing the alternative? And I want to hear your alternative to this kind of go to the city and smoke it up.
There is no alternative in that sense. You see, the search for a particular system is the danger, because then you'll start saying it's communism and, you know, all that nonsense. I mean, any ism is nonsense. Something which is not right, just like when you eat. When something is not right, you don't eat it. You let it be. You don't say, I'll eat it because, well, something else is going to happen. It's not. You're going to get indigestion. You're going to die of something later. So good sense means that you don't eat stuff which is not good for you. So whatever is not good has to be left out, regardless of justification saying, oh, but by taking over this and driving out all the tribals, and then we put up this thing, and now the next generation of tribals is going to have it better. Come on. Look at the current generation who you are, you know, hurting, damaging, killing. And for what? Why do you do that? You don't do it to your children. You don't do it to your brother. You do it to someone else who is somehow distanced from you, usually because of the gulf in the power and money. So,
could you get nominated by the Congress Party to run for parliament?
Unfortunately, I think political solutions, it's necessary. This political system is necessary. It's essential. I'm not for a moment saying that's not needed. But I think change, expecting politicians to change anything anywhere in the world, is silly. They represent certain vested interests. And vested interests naturally support themselves and propagate themselves. So change has to come from somebody else who are not within the political system. And of course, that's the large majority.
Give us a clue where to look for that change.
I would say if people are serious, they start with children. And you educate them not merely in technology and the rest of it, also not in that so-called bogus spirituality, which India kind of talks about all the time, but about real stuff. What's good? Of living well, being kind, being generous, sharing, learning to cooperate, learning to collaborate.
Oh, man, you're my guru. You're the man I came to meet.
Well, thank you. Here we are. But a guru is the most dreadful person. India has lots of them. Because then we suspend our thinking and start listening to what somebody else tells us.
I think that's
India's problem.
I think we must applaud.
You know, where we need to change is the bureaucracy. In India, the bureaucrats control the country. As he says, politicians come and go. They're elected, 5 years they're there, then the next he leaves and the next lot come. But the Indian bureaucrat is there, and over the years they've got more and more corrupt, and they're the ones who actually control India, the bureaucrats. They set down the laws, they decide what's going to happen. If the bureaucrat decides something, they can do it. They are the ones who decide where the roads are going to come. The politician doesn't know where to build a road, where to build a flyover, where to build schools. The politicians are there and they move on. These men know what to do.
Who in the world is going to change the bureaucrats?
That is a question. I don't know who's going to change. I think we citizens have to change them, but that's where the problem in India is. It's more than the politicians, it's the bureaucrats. Why have the Maoists reared their head? The tribals have been marginalized. And it's the bureaucrats who've marginalized them eventually. They don't have schools there, no roads, and they are protesting. They found their peaceful protest didn't work, so they've got violent. And now, of course, it's become completely, it's gone out of control. Completely out of control, the Maoists and this sort of fight between the government and the tribals.
We interviewed Arundhati Roy about the Maoists and the tribal areas where she had spent a lot of time. And people react very strongly to her. Most people think she's right in her heart but wrong in her head. What do you think?
I think she's got the... She's right. You know, somebody needs to talk to them, see what they need. And instead of marginalizing them, because the Maoists haven't erupted in the last 5 years, they've been there for 15, 20 years. So 20 years ago when they were protesting, nobody listened to them. 15 years ago, nobody listened. Now in the last 2 years or 3 years, the government of India is listening to them because they're going around killing the army CRPF men or whether they're blowing up trains. Now we are talking to them, but it's too late. They don't trust, the Maoists and the tribals no longer trust the bureaucrats or the government when they go to negotiate. They don't want to listen to us. And they're saying, you haven't listened to us all these years. What makes you think that we know we can trust you now? And then, of course, there's also vested interests. I know you're American, but I feel that the Americans have got into India very insidiously. They have changed a lot of things, changed culture in India. Multinationals selling toothpaste or selling, fries, French fries or chips. They've changed Indian habits and customs for whatever reason, because they want to sell and they want to make more money. No longer do we work, as you said, like a gurus and sadhus. We have been filled with a lot of information and consumerism from Western countries, which we could do without.
What's the worst?
Indian children, upper class, middle class Indian children, now their aspirations are to be American. The way they dress, the way they eat, their attitudes are all American. There's cinema has influenced India, Hollywood cinema influences India, American TV, all these have influenced India a lot.
Do you see anybody you like on American television?
Yeah, I like Drew Carey.
Message to America.
I have been terribly impressed by America, number one, whether people like it or not. My background is advertising, and therefore, all the more reason that I look forward to that country, who's given us the business communication angle. But I think that in certain instances, from the context of India, I think that America would probably do well if family values were a little more emphasized. Because, you know, like in India, we take care of our elderly parents all the time. Perhaps it's not done in America. And if somebody doesn't do it, he doesn't feel bad or guilty, because that's been the culture. He's seen over generations this is done. And so these are things, particularly from the social point of view, maybe there are a little things which will bring back, bring greater shine into the American way of life.
How is Barack Obama doing in the Indian view?
I think there is an overwhelming view that he's okay. A large part of the Indian community think that their view on India-Pakistan, with Pakistan and India, there's a bit of duplicity. But they also realize that according to priority, he has to run his own country first. And therefore, a little bit of diplomacy perhaps is forgivable, as long as in the long run, he gets onto the right path, which we feel he'll surely do.
What is the lying or the duplicity about in AFPAC?
No, he was talking about of making friends with Pakistan. About 6 months ago, the newspapers, the Times of India newspaper and the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan, they launched something called Aman Ki Asha. And they were trying to make bridge friendship between India and Pakistan. So these newspapers were promoting it. And they also sent musicians from Pakistan to India. We sent musicians to Pakistan, artists, sculptors, designers. We were trying to do this, and I don't know whether it's true, but I was told that the Americans were funding this. it was all done through Indian newspapers and Pakistani newspapers, so the Americans are trying to fund it. But there really is no way that India and Pakistan can ever talk. I mean, it's a foolish thing to accept that we're going to talk. We've been traditionally enemies since they broke away. Since 1947, we've been enemies. If you ask any Indian, who's your enemy? They're not going to say England is our enemy as a nation. You know, not Sri Lanka, not Burma, not even China. We always think of Pakistan as our national enemy. And we'll never make friends. And I think what the Americans, as he says, they realize this, but yet they come and tell us something, and then they hand over huge amounts of money to the Pakistanis to buy arms, and they give them arms. And then where are the arms used? Mainly back on India. They're trying to contain Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but it comes back into India. They, you know, get into our borders.
Ashok, I want to ask you, it's a big industry now to imagine the new India. Nanda Nilekani wrote a book called Imagining India. People talk about an Indian century. What are we waiting for? Is it possible? How will it be done? How do you imagine a new India?
I think we're just going to have to wait this out. And a lot of mistakes are going to be made. And Indian growth has always been organic. We've had so many people trying to direct the way India should move with policy, with politics, with what have you. And it remains at one level talk. And they love to take credit for everything that happens in India, right? But the credit for India is the effort and imagination of 1 billion people. And therefore, I don't think from on top one is going to be able to sort of drive this country in any particular direction. You can mismanage it in many directions, but the way it finds itself moving, it's going to get there. Now, the traditional forces of government, of academia, of intellectuals and all the rest of it, they can either get behind this and enable it, or they can fight it with their fantasies. And right now, I think that's what's happening, that there's a huge amount of baggage we're carrying historically, which has just continued. For example, you just heard about the great Indian bureaucracy, right? We have so many practices we're carrying with us which no longer apply. And we're just carrying them forward out of habit.
All these carbon copies of everything?
No, even the slums. So you've got archaic zoning laws, archaic property laws, all kinds of things which are writing, and lots of pieces of paper get generated. You know, you get urban planning departments which hire thousands of people. But on the ground, what happens? Each Indian in those slums has to make his or her way every morning. And they do. And they survive, and sometimes they even thrive, in spite of all this. So in a sense, no one has revisited these basic processes, which are not rocket science. For example, sanitation and roads, the engineering of those things got solved 200, 250 years ago. And the sewers of Paris are something you'd still aspire to here, you know. So there's a certain amount of pragmatism and a certain amount of engineering that needs to come into the blood.
In this nation of brilliant, brilliant engineers, have you got an engineer that can finally clean up a road project? I mean, say it's done. We picked it up. We planted the grass. It's over. The curb stones are in.
Well, thing is, you can do it. And I have seen it done in small pockets. But to make it a habit where it becomes a norm all over the place, what you're going to need is to get the politician on your side. And I'll explain that. We've spent 50 years, and we have a history that's earlier than that, for a couple of hundred years, where all power got centralized. The citizen got disenfranchised. So why should the decision on what my road looks like or how wide it should be made in Delhi? All right? Why this over-centralization of power? And what you need is variety. So if you hand power over to the citizens, and this is where the lack of trust is, and the vested interest frame was talking about, they all conspire, all this baggage we're carrying. It prevents the citizen on the street from taking power over the little things in life, and these are the things that you see. You know, how level is my sidewalk? You know, how close is my nearest hospital? You know, how far do my kids have to walk to school? Why should these decisions be taken so far away? Now, the moment this decision-making comes down to the local level, to the level of the street, and where each citizen says, I've got the power to decide, that's when you're going to see the explosion. So it's not doing anything, it's unleashing what's already there.
I'm thinking when you speak about centralization, didn't Dr. Ambedkar, who wrote the Constitution, feel that that was one way to protect minorities in the States?
No, I don't think so. I think what happened was people fly various flags to justify what they do. So, for example, in the United States right now, you have a security culture. I was just reading about it in the paper, right? It's gone completely out of control in terms of expense and in terms of manpower and stuff. It's being done in the name of the people, right? It's being done to protect you. So why don't you get behind it? You know, what's your objection to it? So similarly, I mean, everyone will fly flags, and the flags are always noble and in intent. But I'm worried about how do you deploy that intent and what are the results you get out of it. No one seems to be interested in that part of it. All right?
I want to ask Satish a different question about sort of legacies of the past. Is India recovered, would you say, from the British disease? I mean, the Phuka Sahib deference to the colonial power and the anger, the resentment that is all tied up in that.
There were some kind of, disparities, because they actually, what you call, brought in a lot of their own inputs, which sort of divided the country. They ruled the country by division rather than by unison. So when post-independence, this division continued and still diversified. Now we are more a divided country than a unified country.
Divided with Pakistan or divided internally?
For the last so many years or decades, Pakistan has continued to be an errant child. And when that happens, and I think vis-a-vis Pakistan, we've got our back to the wall, really. We really have, that's the feeling that we get. Time and again, we go for discussions. You know, it is certainly my personal feeling that we, in the hierarchy of the government also, there is a problem of knowing what the way forward is.
I think that probably the best way is to ignore the child. Because last week we went for dialogues, 2 months before we went for dialogues, and when they meet the press, what does the foreign minister, Pakistani foreign minister, say? There was no dialogue. It ended, before it started. So there is no dialogue, Satish. It's you ignore them. If they feel marginalized. Every dialogue has collapsed. Now the time has come, you ignore them. Even an errant child, if the mother ignores the child comes running to the mother. So, you ignore them and something will come of it. What is happening now? Nothing good has come out of this dialogue. Nothing good. And sorry, to answer your question about the drones, American drones attacking, these people. I think it's a very futile exercise. The American drone caught that Bayatullah Masood. They knocked him down. And then 2 weeks later, there was a new Bayatullah, Hakimullah Masood came. So then every drone eliminates one leader, and then three others turn up. And that's the American side. From India, dialogue hasn't worked at all. It didn't work last week. And now we are so shameless. We says, okay, they've given a slap in the face to us, to our foreign minister. And then we're saying, okay, in November, we'll have another dialogue. Are we stupid?
If the child abuses the mother is not going to deny the child.
They're not any mother of the Pakistanis.
Ashok, you've given me this notion of a second wave of the new India, sort of building out there, way, way out from shore, and it's thousands, millions of elements of ideas and people and financial resources, technological innovations, social ambitions, political plans. Can you describe it? What's going on inside it? You'll be in it. But can you give us a report from inside the second wave?
Well, it's at the chaos stage right now. It's on the high chaos stage. That's what we see from the inside. So from the outside, when I read stuff that's published out of America and stuff, they seem to be seeing patterns and, being able to see that this is moving from here to there. I don't doubt the movement. It is going from place A to place B. It's going to some place for the better. But it's not yet found its rhythm. Let's put it that way. And right now, it's a churn. It's a maelstrom. So you can see exactly what you want to see. It's all there. All the pieces are there. If you sort of zoom in on one, it's right there and it becomes reality. But if you stand back, you see all this stuff. You got the old, the new, and the sort of the confused present. So if there's a sort of a school of thought right now, it's confusion.
How is it different from the first wave? You were in that one too. You're older, wiser, maybe lazier, maybe more inspired, maybe better educated. How's it different?
Well, that's a fine description, especially the lazy part. But what's different is that the first one was truly the unknown. But now you sort of see it as part of a cycle. So earlier you did not know if this was going to work out. And there was always that doubt. So you threw more effort at the problem and you tried harder. Now you know that it's got the momentum. So you don't have to spin the wheel anymore. It's spinning on its own. And all you have to do is sort of stroke it in the sort of direction you wanted to go in. That's different. And it's no longer a question of will it succeed. Of course it'll succeed. But how quickly can it happen? You know, how can you minimize the sort of misery that's going to happen? Because, I mean, there's a lot of misery in the making also. And these are new kinds of misery. Crime is going to go through the roof. And you can talk to a sort of a sociologist about this. And it's very much America in the 70s. When you had a runaway crime problem and didn't know what to do with it, it was the result of a lot of this.
People say drinking has gone through the roof and drugs will be next.
Okay, Prem is the expert you got to talk on that, because the amount of people he's helped out of alcohol is legend. I mean, you know, he's the man. He's the expert on this. But yeah, all this is happening right now. And you've got a complete churning. And basically, I mean, you've heard it around this table. So everything from the connect with the older generation and parental supervision coming down to crime to the sort of the politics and the school of resentment that Bloom would talk about. And you see that everywhere in politics. Everyone's, you know, is carrying an axe and feeling particularly, you know, sort of resentful about, you know, their particular state. And it's not helped that the politics of India over the last 50 years have been divisive. These were not the politics to bring people together. It was the politics to sort of break them into groups, which were very nice for election time that you could appeal to. But all this is withering away in its time. But it's just a question of, you don't have an end in sight. You don't have a plan. It's hope. And the hope is very strong. And one would like to see the worthies who take our tax money actually putting a plan behind this and, you know, delivering on it.
I want to ask a question to you. Does India need the U.S. or U.S. needs India?
I'd say it's about 70-30. U.S. needs India. U.S. needs India for kind of emotional stability, for a place of the world. When I was a kid, there were great leaders in all around the world. I mean, Charles de Gaulle and Nkrumah in Africa and Nehru in India. We knew we were one piece of a huge, complex family. We've almost forgotten that. Throw in Nasser in Egypt. Not to glorify any particular one, but the United States needs terribly, I think, to be reminded that this is a, praise God, a richly various world. And India has so much history, especially, and ideas, and energy, and God knows, kids to draw on. I think we need you terribly.
And as one finally said, what more can India give? It has given yoga, it has given the Indian philosophy, it has given Kama Sutra. What more can you give?
Gandhi too,
and
Prem Koshi,
and in the famous words of my grandfather, who always used to say, "Listen, buddy, before you go around so hard trying to help the whole world and put it right and set things straight, please try not to become the monkey who pulls the fish out of water to save it from drowning." Ta-da.
Prem Koshi, thank you, as they say in the movie, for rounding up the usual suspects.
Thank you, sir.
This feels like the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.